Colonel Eagle Reel 3.
Jock joined us in this area of the White Pagodas to tell us that Falcon, somewhere in the area of Pinbaum or Chongli, had been jumped by the Japs on the 4th of March. There had been a battle, and the column had been split up, and Jock had been sent by his column commander, Philip Common, to find 8 column and tell us what had happened, and then return to his column. There was no radio communication between 4 column and ourselves, because 4 column's radio had, I think, the mule carrying the radio had been spooked by the Jap fire and had gone off on its own into the blue and had not returned. And this is the reason for using Jock's small party to send us the information. Now, having told us what had happened to his column, Jock then left it and went back to try and find his column. Clearly, he couldn't do so. But shortly after that, just before we took our second airdrop at a village called Zibibin, Jock returned and joined our column for about, well, probably the next month or so. And he was present at the next airdrop, the arrangements for which were exactly the same as Tom McCain. We used a large area of paddy as the DZ, and everything went very smoothly. I can remember while this drop was taking place, the Dakotas were coming in, making a lot of noise. Doc sat beside me, and he started singing Bonnie Strathair. He got an incredibly fine voice. And every time I hear Bonnie Strathair now, my mind goes back to the airdrop at Zibibin. Jock was a fascinating chap, and sadly he didn't stay long with the battalion. He got exceedingly ill the following year when he went to Arakan, and he was in the leave out, and we lost touch of him completely. Later he joined the RAF regiment after the war, and sometime, I think, in the 1950s, he died. He is a fine chap. After we'd taken our second drop, it must have been around about the first week in March, and so far, no aggressive role had been given to 8 column. As far as I was concerned, boredom was starting to set in, as I was never called to attend those groups. I suppose I felt I could have asked Scotty if I could have attended, but in those days I thought that subalterns, like children of a bygone age, be seen and not heard. I never had any bitterness, felt any bitterness towards Scotty for not calling me to his A groups. I only had respect for him. But it would have made my day's march was much more interesting if I had known what was happening, and it had a set of maps. As far as I can remember now, we marched from the airdrop at Zibibin again towards the Irrawaddy in an easterly direction, and our poor mule's galls were getting worse and worse and worse. One day when we finished our marching, we were basing up for the night, I suddenly heard a flute being played very faintly. I didn't know where it was coming from, and I walked around my mule up to the mule to see who was playing the flute, and I saw one of my muleteers, a little chap, 1073-94, Welshman Trimbard and I. I'd seen him making this flute for bamboo a few days previously. He'd obviously completed it now, and he was sitting there playing in a poly tunes. I went up to him, and I smiled at him, and said, "Why are you playing your flute?" He looked up, sat to attention, grinned broadly, and said, "Oh, the mule likes it." And every day from that time on we had to let our mules go. Prembada used to play to his mules. I've often thought of that young man and wondered whether he survived the war. And then
Only the other day, or it must have been in March, I think, I was in touch with the archivist for Tenskirk, it was David Harding, who had read my story of the first Chinook expedition, and he told me that Pembada had been killed as a paid landslide with the first tenth on the 13th of March, 45, near Mike Tiller. Poor lad, he was only about 15 or 16 when he was with me, you see. When he was killed in 45, he'd still have been in his teens. Very young to go. Well, after the episode with the flute, we continued marching for a number of more days. It was a very hard march indeed. And we reached the Irrawaddy, and I understood from column talk that we'd cross somewhere between the big villages of Iniwa on the far bank and Pigang on our side of the bank, on our side of the river. And I understood that probably brigade headquarters, 5 and 7 columns, would be crossing in the same area. When we got to the river, we found the shore was lined by a very wide sandy beach again, and looking across the river, I couldn't believe how wide it was. My eyes and judgment told me that it was probably a mile wide. I've since studied some maps, and the maps indicate it could be up to 2 miles wide. Whether it was as wide as two or not, I don't know, but anyway, it is a substantial obstacle for troops to cross with all their equipment. The villagers were able to produce for our Burma riflemen quite a number of big country boats, and in the event our crossing was surprisingly easy. Again, the boats were paddled by villagers, and again we tethered tied our ropes to the sterns of the boats. So they poured air as they had to swim while we travelled over by boat, and they were in bad order by this time, and how they managed that river I really don't know. It was a tremendous effort on their part. Sadly though, of course, some got loose and pulled away from the boat, and their toggle ropes, their lead ropes rather, were jerked out of the hands of the muleteers holding them, and they got separated. But they continued across the village, across the river in our wake, and got to the other side without any loss at all. But our mules and 7 column mules were mixed up, and there was some confusion until we got things sorted out. Unfortunately, I lost one of my favourite mules at this time. She went over to a 7 column. And I suppose she carried on with them. Having crossed the Irrawaddy, we started to march southeast towards Mulmit or Mubak. I'm not quite sure what our objective was. And after some days and a further 30 or 40 miles in distance, we reached the vicinity of the village Bor. When we were at Bor, an odd episode happened. As far as I know from column talk, one of the rifle platoons, King's rifle platoons, commanded by a subaltern called Joe Coghlan, was sent for some purpose or other to Bor. Whether he was on a reconnaissance or a fighting patrol, I never heard. But anyway, he had contact with a Jap force. I don't know how large the Jap force was, but there was a firefight. Whether Japs were killed or not, I don't know. I don't know whether any King's men were killed, but they certainly had wounded. And obviously, Scotty must have sent a report to Wingate describing what had happened. And Wingate took extreme umbrage over the action of Joe Coghlan's platoon. And brigade headquarters were obviously in our immediate area. And Scotty was told to produce Joe Coghlan in front of Wingate, but he was summarily court-martialed. He was reduced to the rank of private and
and sent in disgrace from us to Bernard Ferguson's Five Column. I heard after the war, or after the expedition finished, and we got back to India, that Joe very rightly was given back his rank, but this court-martialing of Joe Cobham caused a great stir amongst the subalterns of 8 Column. He was a much liked man, a good officer, and whether he did right or wrong with his patrol to war, who can say, but we thought the punishment was excessive. The trouble was in those days, bearing in mind the circumstances we were under, it was impossible for any commander to give adequate punishment when someone transgressed. So perhaps there was some reason, if Wingate was angered by what Joe Cobham's platoon did or did not do, it is understandable why Wingate might have taken the action he did, but at the time we thought it was very harsh and unjust. But I myself was as guilty as Wingate on two occasions. I found some night, a week or so prior to the encounter in Bor, one of my muleteers was on sentry duty. He was found to have been asleep by one of the NCOs. So naturally, he was produced in front of me. And the only punishment I could give him was to flog him. So I told one of my senior knights, Knight Budiman, to tie him to a tree, not to take his shirt off, and to beat him with one of the mule's lead ropes. But I told him he must not, under any circumstances, break the boy's skin, otherwise it would be impossible for him to carry his back. He was beaten so as to shame him into realizing what a terrible mistake he had made, to fall asleep on sentry in the middle of enemy territory, was putting immediately his comrades' lives at risk, and I felt an example had to be made of him. He was duly beaten, no harm was done except his morale, and everything was forgotten. He forgave us, and we forgave him. The other strange disciplinary action I had to take was over my portly habitat, Putkadoj. He was not passing on my orders, and I decided that something had to be done. So I called him to me one day, and I explained to him in detail what I thought his errors were. And, loyal chap that he was, he entirely agreed with my criticism. And when I told him that he could no longer remain as my senior NCO, that I must reduce him, albeit temporarily, to the rank of rifleman, and give his position to another, he, with great grace, agreed with all that I said, and he accepted my punishment without demur. I felt an absolute brute, but I really thought it had to be done. And so, in Prokhoroj's place, I promoted Knight Budiman to Havildar, and a very fierce-looking paid lance knight, Harkabada Limbu, who had enlisted in the tents just before the war. He was promoted to Knight in Budiman's place, and a young rifleman who was in charge of the headquarters section of my muleteers, Pasang Lama, who had been born close by the tent center in Shillong. He was promoted in the field to paid Knight. And he did exceptionally well as a junior NCO. He was a most impressive young man, and I'm sure if he survived the war, he'd have gone on to do great things. He was a great favourite with the BORs, and particularly with the Company Sergeant Major Chivas. Sergeant Major Chivas and Pasang were great friends, no doubt about that. And all the BORs knew Pasang as Johnson. And to hear Johnson, who knew hardly any English at all, carrying on the conversation with the BORs was
was very, very funny indeed. I wish to goodness I'd made some notes and written down these conversations, because they really were worth a game in it. Well, after these changes in our column, the change of Joe Coughlin going over to five column and my changes within my small command, we moved from Bor north and northeast to the Swale River. The Swale's source is somewhere near Lungling in China, not very far away. We must have reached the Swale 15 to 20 miles or so north of Bor. We found the river at this point quite narrow, 30 to 40 yards wide, but it was very deep and very fast flowing. And prior to crossing it, Scotty sent Tag Sprague's commandos over the river. They swam, carrying a joint, 20 or 30 joint topper ropes, which they first tied to a tree on the near bank. They swam across and then tied the other end of the rope to a tree at the far bank. And this gave us a line across the river. The men then made bamboo rafts to help the non-swimmers cross and to carry our kit, and the mules again were towed behind the rafts when we eventually started crossing. The rafts were grasped by the occupants of the rafts, to the toggle loop. So I should say that. Can we go?
That's all right, just corrected.
The toggle ropes were grasped by the occupants of the rafts, and we managed to pull ourselves across to the other side without any problem at all. As we were crossing, or perhaps it was just before we crossed, Scotty told me that he was shortly before going to India, and that he reckoned it would be a good thing if I killed one of our mules and provide some fresh meat to augment the rations which had been dropped at the beginning, which were now starting to run out. So I chose the sickliest mule of all, a poor little brindle beast, who'd got very bad galls, and I took my pistol out and shot her between the eyes, just about the centre of her forehead. And she dropped stone dead at my feet, and I felt an absolute brute having to do this, but at least I was able to put one of my ailing mules out of their misery. And I hoped to provide a meal for the soldiers, as Scotty had wished. Unfortunately, when the meat was cooked and eaten, it was really very unpleasant. It was somewhat sour and exceedingly tough. It was really rather a waste of an animal's life. We never did it again. We never tried to eat our mules after that. Well, we finally crossed the Swale, and now we must have been perhaps only 70 miles from the China border. That night, having crossed the Swale, the thoughts of return to India were very much in our minds, and we wondered when it would occur, how long it takes to get back. And I really wondered why on earth we'd come into Burma, because we and Aitken had done absolutely nothing. We'd had this minor contact in Bor, and that was it. And I thought we'd marched a very long way from nothing. But from the Swale, having crossed it, we marched north now for some 2 days, and then we came to a dry 20 to 30 foot wide chong bed with possibly 2 foot high banks. And here, I believe, Tag Sprague's platoon was sent off on a reconnaissance. And the rest of us remained for a while in this dry chong bed. Eventually, a platoon was left in the chong bed as first base, as firm base. And the rest of the column, together with our mules, moved forward towards the Zinbong Forest Rest House. I did not know where we were going at the time, but subsequently one of the King's platoon commanders showed me on his map where we had been heading. And the sequence of events from now was, to say the least, somewhat confused. If my memory is correct, we had a platoon in front of my mules and me, and a platoon behind. We are marching in single file, as always, what we call column snake. The men, as usual, were bunching. No one seemed to worry in Wingate's brigade whether troops bunched on the march or not, and a well-trained infantryman knows only too well if you bunch, you present a target, and if you're hit, you're going to suffer heavily. But no one had been able to teach us that lesson as yet. The time was almost to come. The vegetation on either side of the track we were marching along was primary jungle, some secondary, some lantana, and some sal. It wasn't desperately thick, so one could see quite a number of yards ahead or to a flank. Suddenly, there was rifle fire in front. Very sharp cracks, something like our own deeper sound of the Lee Enfield's firing. So I, for one, assumed it must be jet fire. It continued intermittently for some while, and incoming rounds were hitting the trees just ahead of me. Then I saw the BORs and the leading platoon running back. They were shouting and yelling. And I yelled at one or two of them who were near to me as they ran back, "What's happened?" And they cried back, "Japs." I was standing there in the middle of the track with my rifle at the high port, loaded, ready to fire. And I thought, would I see my first Jap or would I not? And suddenly, I saw one. Range, goodness knows, 20 yards perhaps. I put my rifle up to my shoulder. I'd taken the first pressure on the trigger and was about to fire, and suddenly a BOR's head blotted out my target. Then the Jap fired. Whether he fired at the BOR or at me, I don't know, but I heard the crack and the thud of the bullet striking the sand between my feet. And I thought to myself, well, if that round had been inches to the right or left, I'd have been a candidate for Wingate's policy of casualty evacuation. There was confusion in extreme up front, and eventually, as far as I can recall, the remainder of the leading platoon came rushing back in full retreat, pell-mell, their hats awry, their eyes wide as terror. The sight of fleeing soldiers is very infectious, and my men, in sympathy, turned about with their mules and started leading. Running as fast as they could, for this couldn't go on. So I roared out to my men in the party, "Nadova, don't run." And best they said was they stopped running. They broke into slow time again, or quick time, I should say, and carried on in an organized fashion. I now find myself as rear guard, as the animal transport officer. And I thought to myself, well, at least now I surely get sight of a Jap and have another shot. And I'd be able to kill my first Jap, not a bit of it. Those Japs involved in the contact didn't follow up, surprisingly. So we eventually got back to the Chonberg, where the platoon had been holding the firm base. And I spoke to the platoon commander of the lead platoon and asked him just what had happened. He told me they had bumped two Japs. Two, only two. The Japs had fired, and the leading platoon had followed out Wingate's dispersal drill to the letter. The only thing that was missing for lack of a bugle call. Wingate had really opened a Pandora's box when he told people to carry out a dispersal drill on meeting the enemy. It was an absolute shambles. And there were a lot of young men in 8th Column that evening who hung their heads in shame. They realised that they'd made a complete bog of it, and they'd done, to put it mildly, less than they should have done. And
did the two Japanese get away?
Oh, yes, scot-free. I mean, I couldn't fire at this chap, because he suddenly blotted out for the BOR's head. Whether any of the leading platoon soldiers fired at the Japs or not, I don't know. I certainly didn't hear the sound of Lee Enfield's being fired. Well, what I thought after that was, if a field commander teaches bad tricks in training, it is guaranteed that troops will behave incorrectly on contacting the enemy for the first time. And it's a lesson that was hoisted in by me, and I have no doubt by many others in 8th Column on that regretful morning. A platoon sergeant, I suspect he must have been with the leading platoon, was wounded. He is shot in the thigh, and as he'd already got VD, which he'd picked up in Chauncey at Christmas time, he was having difficulty in walking in any case. He was in very bad order indeed. Whether he got back to India in the end, I never knew. But shortly after Wingate's brigade broke up into escape parties and we dispersed back to India. So whether this unfortunate sergeant lived or died, I do not know. But after that incident, Scotty ordered us to march west to the Irrawaddy, which is now about 30 miles away. And we reached the Big River at the end of March, beginning of April. We were, as far as I could gather, I repeat, I had no maps at this stage, not far from the big village of Inewa. And I understood that in the general area was brigade headquarters, 5 and 7 columns, as well as our 8 column. In other words, a force of about 700 men. I also gathered that a bridgehead platoon from 5 or 7 columns had been sent to the west bank of the Irrawaddy as bridgehead. Not long after I actually reached the area of the river, I heard heavy firing coming from where obviously the bridgehead platoon was located. There was Jap 4-inch mortar fire and medium machine gun fire. Now their medium machine guns had a totally different sound to arm because medium machine guns. Theirs had a much slower rate of fire. Top, 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 top. And the BORs later in the war, I gather, used to refer to it as the woodpecker, and it's a very apt name as it sounded just like a woodpecker. No doubt about that in my mind. Anyway,